Today is November 20th, 2024. I am interviewing Reverend Ina Anderson, who is a reverend, a playwright, and director of Emerging Voices Theater Company. In the past, she was a member of the Bridgeport Fire Department. Let's start at the very beginning. Ina, where and when were you born, and who were your parents?
I was born where? In Kingstree, South Carolina. And my parents are David and Willie Alfred Anderson. And August 8th, 1958.
And tell me about your birth family. What occupation did your parents have? And did you have any siblings?
My dad worked for Jenkins Valve, AFCOLA Combing, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom until she got involved into the Bridgeport school system. And from the school system being a part of the parent committee, she went on to do quite a bit. She ended her career working for the Bridgeport Housing Authority as senior management.
And when did you said you were born down south. Mm-hmm. When did your family move to Bridgeport?
My dad came here after he got out of service because his brother was here. So once they established that, which I think was, not exactly sure, but it was in the 50s. And my mom went south to have me with her mom because my dad was away in the military. And then once everything was all set up here, we made our way here. So all of my schooling was done here. And I have two brothers and another sister.
And where did you go to elementary school and high school? And what was your favorite subject? And did you have any extracurricular activities such as sports, music, or drama club?
Okay. So I went to Waltersville School, the old Waltersville School. For elementary, for early learning. Then Eastside Middle School opened up in, I believe, 70 or 69, Eastside Middle School became a thing. So I went there for junior high. High school, I went to Harding High School. I graduated in 1976. And my favorite subject was history. And my extracurricular activities were the band and the drama ministry.
And what TV shows, radio stations, radio programs, newspapers, type of music did you and your family enjoy when you were growing up?
Oh, wow. So radio programs, I don't recall us listening to the radio. My family was probably one of the first families to have a television and then a color television. So, we watched a lot of news. As a kid, I can remember like My Three Sons, Dennis the Menace, and then Julia. I remember the first black program that came on television, which was Julia. And I enjoyed watching that. Music, we listened to all kind of music. My mom was a big jazz fan. And so I'm trying to think of his name, Nat Alder. Edible. Anyway, so Jimmy Smith and a few others I grew up listening to. gospel we listened to, but a lot of the 19, I remember music mainly from the 60s. So Johnny Taylor, all of Motown, that's what we listened to. Happy music. It was always happy music.
If you didn't listen to the radio that much, how'd you listen to your music? Was it those 33 LPs,
yes,
vinyl?
Ma'am. Yes, ma'am. 33 LP vinyls.
We had, on a record player.
Yes, we had a record player. And I think my first event that I can remember on the television was when President Kennedy got shot, because we were sent home from school. That's when you were in kindergarten, and you got a kindergarten was a half a day. So we did kindergarten, or if you were in all day kindergarten, that particular day I remember us getting sent home from school in 63 when Kennedy got shot, and that being something that we saw on the television.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I don't think you said where you went to high school. You said where
Warren
you went.
Warren Harding.
Warren Harding High School.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. I graduated in 1976, Warren Harding High School, the blue and the gold.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And did you work in the summers or after school hours when you were growing up?
No, because my parents were told they made too much money.
So you couldn't work?
So I could not work.
Really?
Look at the look on your face. Yes.
I never heard of such thing.
Yes, we did not qualify for a lot of things because my parents' income was said to be too much. So I had friends that had summer jobs, but I didn't get a summer job until I was probably almost 17 years old. And by that time, I was graduating high school, so I went out and got a real job.
And did you go to college? And if so, where? And what did you study?
Officially, I was signed up to go to North Carolina A&T, of which I didn't go because I had a cousin. I had a cousin who transferred, and she was the one that always got me in trouble, and I just kind of refused to go to school with her. So I did go to Housatonic and take some classes, but I also went...
Housatonic Community College in Bridgeport.
In Bridgeport, over on Barnum Avenue. Yes. And then... I went to Connecticut Business Institute and I took up accounting. So I did 2 years of that and got my certificate in accounting. And what else? I eventually, back in 2015, went to the College of Kansas, Christian College. It was Kansas Christian College. I did online courses with them.
To become a reverend?
Oh, no. To finish up my business degree.
Oh, okay.
To become a reverend, I went to Harford Seminary. And just by way of church...
And what year did you go to the seminary?
Seminary, I went in 2000 and, now you're trying to get me to remember, 2004, 2005.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, back in 2005.
What was your first job as an adult?
My first job as an adult was working at Perkin-Elmer in Norwalk.
And what is Perkin-Elmer?
Oh, God, Beth. Perkin-Elmer was a big company. Actually, in the United States, Perkin-Elmer is one of the largest companies that produced chips. They created a machine, a semiconductor machine, that created chips.
You mean potato chips?
No, chips like in your phone.
Oh, okay.
So some of the first chips Some of the first chips ever made came out from PerkinElmer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
You
and the
were ahead of
space
your
tele
time.
yeah space telescope that the first space telescope to go up, which was the Hubble, came out of PerkinElmer. So I got to see the process of that scope being made, and actually participating with Mr. Bob Ock, who was one of the major opticians that worked for PerkinElmer to produce that lens.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you have a significant other or partner? And do you have any children of your own or adopted?
Well, I got married in 1980 to Joseph Williams, who is now deceased. And out of that union was two children, Tiffany and Joseph, and they are now 42 and 38.
Wow. And what jobs or career paths have you taken since you worked at Perkins?
So PerkinElmer, I left PerkinElmer in 94. When I left in 94, I was the first black female hired by the city of Bridgeport, as a firefighter. So I went from that to firefighting.
What'd you have to do to become a firefighter? Was there any training?
Yeah, well, you had to take a written test, pass the written test, you had to do the physical test. And the year that I took that test, over 3,000 people took the test. So it was a big number of people they were looking to hire from that list. And you had to not only pass the physical test, which was grueling, then you went into training. So we would go into, if you were hired, then you would proceed to training.
And so you were the first black woman that Bridgeport hired for
Yes.
their fire department?
Yes.
Were you the first woman?
No, not the first woman. I was the first black woman. I was the first woman to be promoted to officer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Thank
Congratulations.
you.
And so what years to what years were you on the fire department?
From two, let's see, 1994 to 2004, I want to say. 1994 to 2004.
And what did you do after you quit the force?
Well, I retired from the force,
You
and I
retired.
retired from the force. It was a disability pension, because I did get hurt several times, but eventually came out on a disability retirement. And after that, I don't know, I might have had two small jobs, of none of which I liked. And that's, I went to volunteer for the church full time.
Which church?
Mount Airy Baptist Church.
In Bridgeport,
Yes, in
Connecticut.
Bridgeport, Connecticut. And so volunteering for the church full time, and then I started taking up my old passion of directing again. So I started writing plays and helping with the Maafa. And
Can you explain what my office is?
Maafa is a key Swahili term that means the great calamity or disaster. In the transatlantic slave trade, starting from the year of 1444, and I say to present. So it was the telling of stories from Africa to America, and the laws that went along with that transition. And so we, along with the church in Brooklyn, New York, St. Paul Community Baptist Church of Brooklyn, New York, embarked upon this journey to tell that story of Africa to America, what took place within the Americas, and to educate people of the history, because they didn't teach this when I was growing up.
They still don't teach it.
Yeah, I
And
know.
And there's a big pushback
Yeah,
to
there is.
people who want to teach it.
Right. And it's very unfortunate because history is history. And no one should get to be able to tell you what that history is. And it's something to be able to see from the transitions of how black people in America were treated and the laws that were created to continue that treatment. And so it's very interesting, this country.
That's a nice way of
Yeah,
putting it.
very interesting.
And are you still with the church?
No, currently I am not. But when I branched out, I felt a calling out. So my calling out was to start my own company, to further explore not just the slave, that historical part of history. Like I said, when I grew up, I loved history. So I always pushed to explore all of history. And so the company, as it came into existence, its first job was to explore our current president-elect, which back in 2016, he had won the election. And I came out with Trumpnetized. So that was the first production of the company on its own. And it differed in a way where it was the inclusion of Europeans beyond being a slave master. Because all Europe, all people of Caucasian descent were not mean, evil people. So there has to be a truth telling. There has to be a series of truth tellings, which means everybody's included. You cannot exclude anyone to tell your story because everybody has a part within the story, whether positive or negative. So you get to I got the opportunity to dig a little deeper and to move a little farther out and to be more inclusive in the truth telling.
And could you give us the titles of some of the plays and a brief synopsis of what they were about
Well,
that you wrote?
sure. Well, I did, let's see, how many years of Ma'afa? Ma'afa was never the same story. So I took over as head director of Ma'afa in 2011. So I told the story of Black Wall Street. Then there were
And
just.
what's Black Wall
Well, Black
Street?
Wall Street was known as one of the most progressive cities in the country that was owned, operated, and ran by black people. Just like with Rosewood and Oscarville and a few other towns across the country. After the Reconstruction era, there was this pushback. Right? Because during the Reconstruction era, which most of us don't know anything about, because history had wiped it off of its lens, black people took part after the Civil War in being responsible to the political system of the country. And so there were black senators, black representatives that were a part of the country's politics. And after 1877, with the large influx of the Ku Klux Klan and the government and the laws that were created, the new Jim Crow, all of that was dismissed, erased, eradicated. And but it didn't stop black people from creating cities. Creating, they were bankers, they were librarians, they had owned property, they were They had their own planes and their own, they just were separate and independent of functioning with white folks who didn't want them there. So they had their own towns and their own schoolings and their own, they had their own. And then there was a big pushback in the throughout history, but in particularly during the early 1920s. Lynching became a thing. Burning down towns became a thing where people were, black people were massacred in large numbers. And
Is
so,
that what happened to Black Wall
yes,
Street?
Black Wall Street was a 35 block community. And it was some little funny story that was told about a black man and a white elevator operator and a scream. And he was arrested. She left town, but the town wanted to hang the man that they had arrested, wanted the sheriff to turn over the guy that was arrested. And black folks came and said, "No, we're not doing the hanging thing." And the first night, which took place on not Labor Day, Memorial Day.
And what year was this?
This was in 1921.
Oh, okay.
1921. And there was a fight that ensued. Everybody sort of kind of thought they were going home their separate ways, but the following morning, thousands, white folks came back by the thousands. And they burned, they looted, they bombed buildings. They like literally leveled.
Like it was a war.
Yeah, they leveled that whole town. They killed hundreds of people. The insurance companies never paid any of those persons for their homes, for the loss of their merchandise, for any of that. And when it was all over with, so we know that they bombed from the air. So we know that the government had a part, took a part. We know that a Gatling gun was present.
What's that?
That's a Gatling gun, a big automatic rifle, like you see in the movies where they would turn the handles and the bullets would
Oh,
go through.
yeah.
So the people were running away from the fire, but then they were coming in contact with bullets that were being fired at them. Yeah, very vicious, very, very, very
And you wrote a
disturbing.
play
And I
about
wrote a
it.
play about it. And so that was one. I've written some of everything. Any
You
atrocity.
wrote about a young guy who was studying to be a reverend or a
Yes, his name was
priest.
Jonathan Daniels. And Jonathan Daniels was a white young minister who was in college at the time in New Hampshire who watched television during the Edmund Pettus Bridge, that whole fiasco of black people being beaten by the state troopers of Alabama.
When
And
they wanted the right to vote, right?
right, they were marching for the right to vote. And when Dr. King put out the call and asked for all people of whatever your creed, whatever your religion, to come and march with them. And people came out. They came out. And Jonathan Daniels, he didn't. He came back to Alabama. He had the ability to go to Alabama the first time the college was able to give him credit for being in that space, but he had to go back to take a test in order to pass his grade. He was able to leave, I believe it was in March or April of that year. But he came back. He went back to Alabama because he felt like he needed to be there. And It just, people are evil. And he ran into a sheriff who was going to shoot Ruby Sales. And Jonathan Daniels jumped in to protect her, and he lost his life, saving her life. And she's still living. She
And
got,
you brought her here to
yeah, she was brought
Bridgeport.
to Bridgeport. She saw that play, and we interviewed and talked later, and she said that she had not heard that voice in all them years, and it scared her. She wanted to leave the theater, but she sat through it. I think it was eye-opening for her, and it made an incredible impact on her life and how she continues to do the work of social justice. So that was really, really powerful. That was cool. And then Emerging Voices produced the Mbutu Project, which took place in back in June of this year. And the Mbutu Project was I Am Because We Are. It's a South African term that says people are people by other people. So it was a production that was to talk about how we see each other and how we can live amongst each other and to call out, to bring forth history. To say what happened with breeding, because that's another thing that's not talked about in this country as if it didn't happen. My question was, is if there were only 500,000 enslaved people brought to this country, and by the late 1800s, there were probably 4 million, and then another 12 million. Where did all those people come from? And they were bred. Once once slavery was prohibited in the country, in the U.S., what happened was in the South, owners did not have to give an accounting about their slaves. So they came up with this ingenious plan. Since we can't bring any more into the country, we'll just breed them. We'll make them have babies. And they did. They made them have babies. And they were always, there was some who had promised, if you give me 15 pups, I'll give you your freedom. I know. But this is the history, and this is a history that nobody wants to talk about. And I can get part of the reason why, but history is history, and we should all know it.
And where did you show these plays?
The Bijou Theater, the Klein Memorial, St. John's Episcopal Church, where
All
else?
these places are in Bridgeport,
All those places
Connecticut.
are in Bridgeport. I've been to South Carolina, to Aiken, South Carolina, and to Brooklyn, New York.
And where is your office?
My office is at 305 Knowlton Street here in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Do you have any new plays that you're working on?
I'm in the process of one of the things about writing plays. I'm not big on new plays as much as I am about refining what we already have. Because if you were to expand, you only can get but so much information into 1 hour 30 minutes. You don't want to tax people in their time to keep their attention. So the work we do, I call edutainment because it's more than entertainment. There's always some lesson that I'm always trying to stretch the mind, some information to give while we're doing the play, so that while it's entertaining, yes, you're being educated enough to go, I need to go look that up. And so Ubuntu is one of those productions that can ever have a spin on it. I do want to bring back One of Love and Trumpnatize. As long as he's around, we got work.
Has Bridgeport changed over the years, and if so, in what ways?
Oh, wow. The landscape of Bridgeport is changing. And it has changed over the years, but in what ways? I can remember when the drug epidemic started. Back in the 70s, when the guys would come back home from the Vietnam War, we saw heroin and heroin usage, addicts, drugs just overtake our communities. From there, you saw this thing about urban renewal. And we didn't know what urban renewal exactly meant, but most of what happens within our cities, within the state, within our country, they are fueled by social bylaw. There are a lot of things that are voted into law, a lot of laws that have been created that are on the books that people don't know about, don't recognize, or they wonder, how are you able to do X, Y, Z? And it's all by law. And so I've seen the political structure fractured. I've seen communities destroyed, fractured. I've seen from the riots of the 60s to just things being different, all here in the city of Bridgeport.
They had riots here in Bridgeport?
Yes. Back in the 60s, yeah, it was hot. It was hot here. In the 60s too, well, not in the 60s. Also, what used to be very interesting was the mafia. In the late 70s, early 80s, you know, there were a lot of things that would go on in the city of Bridgeport on Madison Avenue that was just like, we really do live in this gangster town. it's a gangster town. And so I've watched that side of town change as well. You know, so when you... The thing that I learned on the fire department that I didn't really realize until then was that each side of town has a characteristic of its own.
Yeah. And how would you characterize the different parts of town?
Well, all of them are very territorial, number one. The east side is very different from the east end. The East End was very different from the West End and the West End from the North End. And unless you came to fight, everybody pretty much stayed on their sides of town. Unfortunately, that mindset is the thing that has taken hold of our children. Because when you talk about gang-related situations, literally, it's usually because somebody from another side of town comes into your side of town and there becomes this issue. And then within those sides of town, there's these little mini groups. So everybody's always battling for some sort of territory that don't belong to them in the first place. It's terrible.
And also, buildings have changed.
Oh, buildings have changed immensely. Now, for
instance, because your elementary school, Waltersville,
gone.
And your Housatonic Community College used to be on Barnum Avenue.
Right.
You said it's now downtown.
Warren Harding High School, as I knew it, next to Bridgeport Hospital, gone. So that's up the street over where the OGE building used to be. Then gentrification and what I called serial displacement. So serial displacement takes and breaks up a community, right? And when you break up what you have known as community for most of your life, you also break up its political block. And when you do that, you rebuild it, you make it look nice, but then you make it so expensive that the people who had to move out in order for you to do any upgrades can't afford to move back. So there goes community. So now most people don't know who their neighbor is. Their neighbors don't have a stake in the community because they didn't grow up there. So it's a vicious cycle that grows up. So when you look at the east side over where Boca is, that was a whole community. Where Boca is, across the street where, I don't even know what the name of it.
Starbucks is.
Starbucks, all of that. The big store that's over there, I don't know what that is. It sits right on the property where my parents, where I grew up at. So that's gone too. So everything is gone. You know, Ryan's Marina used to be across the street down towards Stratford Avenue. Now they moved them further back up the street into this little spot. So there's a lot of things. Father Panic is no longer there. The Remington buildings have come down and all of that's getting ready to change. They put up a new, on the property where Father Panic used to be, is mixed housing, and then two new schools, and they've built more housing, and they're talking about a train station. So it's all changed. It has all changed. And when you look at the city, throughout the city, and see that over the last, 50 years, that things have changed, they have. They really, really have.
What are your closing thoughts, feelings, opinions about your life and the city of Bridgeport?
Oh, my closing opinions about my life. I've lived a good life. And I look forward to whatever else God has for me to do. That's number one, which is still quite a bit. The city of Bridgeport is changing, and it's going to continue to change. I'm saddened on one hand about our education system, because it just seems like they cannot get that together. There's a lot of talent here. There's a lot of smart, educated people who are here. But the town in and of itself is being taken over by New Yorkers. So the dynamics of the town is shifting. In another 20 years, we won't recognize most of what Bridgeport looked like. There's a lot of things that have come down. There's a lot of plans for things to go up. But we'll see. Bridgeport has always got the short end of the stick from the state. And all of that political garbage that keeps shorting the city. What I see in the people are that they're tired. And so people don't push as hard, don't fight as hard, don't stand as long, and they don't teach their children to do the same, right? So a lot of people sit back and go, what's the use? What's the point? And as an artist, I'm here to remind them that there is a point, that there is hope. Now, I always have to ask myself, because again, playwriting is one of those things that you would think that the theater would be overflowing with people who want to come to plays, but it's not. And it's not a cheap business to be in, right? And so the question for an artist always is how long do I stick this out and stay here? Because a prophet in his own home is without honor. And so do you go somewhere else? Do you stay and fight? I happen to love this town. I think that it has great potential. It has great people. But I think that the people need to, there needs to be an awakening and a reevaluating of the value of being here. Because it's a value, it's a great value. But you gotta make it work. You gotta show up. You gotta, you know, I can remember the days when we would just show up at City Hall in numbers. They would hold a meeting, the people would be there. And they don't know why they're there, but they're there. And to get people to come out now, you know, everybody's just trying to make it home from work and do what they gotta do. They're a slave to what they do, and it's like, you know, yeah. And it's like, no, you still have to fight. You still gotta, you know, we have to have some hope somewhere. And so that is the job of the artist, to give hope, to always show a glimmer of hope, to always tell the truth, to always remember and help us remember.
Thank you, Reverend Ina Anderson.
Thank you, Beth.
And that concludes this interview with Reverend Ina Anderson, who is a reverend, a playwright, and director of Emerging Voices Theater Company. And in the past, she has been a member of the Bridgeport Fire Department. And thank you very much.
Thank you.